هذا لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah, and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing."
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Humanitarian aid, access to food, water, and medicine has long been considered a fundamental red line that governs conduct during war, conflicts, and even genocide. UN agencies, the Red Cross, doctors, and journalists have traditionally been granted immunity in these situations, regardless of the brutality unfolding around them. But the recent events in Gaza, where Israel's actions has rewritten international law through the bloodshed of Palestinians and the silence of the world, has shattered this principle. In the past month alone, at least 109 Palestinians have been killed at 8 distribution centers operated by the U.S. Israeli-backed so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Just today, 36 desperate Palestinians lost their lives. The UN no longer wants a famine in Gaza. It declares that famine is already here. We now live in a world that has grown disturbingly accustomed to watching children literally starve to death. This is the reality we'll examine today on the Spotlight.
Famine warnings in Gaza are ignored. The United Nations says the Israeli siege has left hundreds of thousands of children under the age of 5 malnourished. The only sliver of hope for starving civilians in Gaza is the U.S.-administered aid centers that are essentially killing machines.
As of the 13th of July, we have recorded 875 people killed in Gaza while trying to get food. 674 of them were killed in the vicinity of GHF sites.
And the deliberate targeting of aid-seeking civilians has been clearly recounted by survivors.
They started shooting at us, and we lied down on the ground. Tanks and military vehicles arrived. Soldiers got out of them and started shooting at people while they were on the ground. Then they withdrew and we started checking ourselves, and there were about 20 martyrs.
The United Nations has openly called these American sites a death trap and stressed Israel's obligation to allow more aid in.
People are being killed simply trying to feed themselves and their families. The search for food must never be a death sentence. Let me be clear. Israel, as the occupying power, is required by international law to agree to and to facilitate humanitarian relief. Meanwhile, humanitarian operations continue to be strangled.
UN representatives have also criticized the U.S.-backed aid centers, saying they violate international principles.
Tragic incidents in Gaza near GHF sites remind us that there are no blurred lines with regard to the respect of international humanitarian law.
Far from addressing humanitarian issues, these mechanisms have become symbols of dishonoring human dignity and putting the lives of those in need at risk.
Yet the Israeli regime continues to kill those seeking aid, and the international community fails to take tangible action. And even though Palestinians remain resilient, the world should not ignore its duty to protect innocent lives.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And now let us bring in our guest, joining us now from Ramallah. We have Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University. We also have Mohsen Saleh, academic and political commentator, joining us from Beirut. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. So this is an issue you guys are well familiar with. But let us start from Ramallah first with Mr. Saad Nimr. The current impact of the Israeli atrocities and the blockade of aid on Gaza's civilian, especially the young population, in your opinion, how will that change going forward? The way the world is going to be looking at war, the engagement of war, or any sort of conflict going forward?
Well, I think even for today it became, you know, unbearable totally what's going on in Gaza, and especially when you are mentioning the issue of hunger and thirst for the Palestinian people in Gaza. What the world is doing, the world is conspiring against the Palestinians in Gaza. This is, I mean, you know, especially Western countries, apart from, you know, a few only, maybe we can, not an exception for them, but the rest are all participants in this genocidal war, and especially with hunger. Everyone is seeing what's going on. When we are talking about numbers, so far we are talking about 69 children died because of hunger so far. Today we have three died of hunger, this day. We are talking about 60,000 other children are under the threat of being killed and die because of hunger. We are talking about 55,000 women who are pregnant, and maybe they will be, you know, can't even give birth, or the children can't get enough food and milk, the babies, I mean. And this is also under this danger. What we are talking about here is a kind of a war which is designed in a way to exterminate the Palestinians in Gaza. And what is the reaction of the world? Is silence. Now, Gaza is eating this word silence. That's what they eat in Gaza. What the world is doing nothing to what's going on. Where is the United Nations? Why United Nations can't even discuss this issue? It became unbearable. It became now unstoppable by Israel. What about the European countries? As I said, apart from a few countries here and there. But mostly, where are the 57 Islamic countries, including Arab countries? Where are they? I mean, okay, don't send rockets to Israel. Don't fight with Israel, but at least send some food, for God's sake. Put some pressure. Make some really big noise about what's going on. I'm really, really sorry. I'm sorry today. I'm angry because what's going on is became now over even that you can think of what's going on. People are dying in front of our eyes, on screens, and no one is doing anything, and no one wanted to do anything.
Okay, stay with me. I want to cross over now to Beirut, to Mr. Mohsen Saleh. Mr. Mohsen Saleh, you just heard what our previous guest said about 60,000 children who are at the verge of, you know, starving to death. And we have a situation, like he mentioned, where the Arabs, in the recent visit by Trump, were able to give trillions of dollars. Like he mentioned, no one is expecting any missiles to be sent, but at least some sort of political pressure to be applied to the Americans to allow for at least aid to come in, just like some sort of political pressure was applied to assist Syria to lift some of its sanctions. Why do you think there is this inability of the Arabs to collectively act to protect Gaza in whatever capacity they can?
Good evening to you and to your guest, and greetings, all the greetings to the audiences in Palestine, and as well in the Arab and the Islamic world and the international community, who are having this feeling towards this genocide, this massacres, daily massacres in Gaza. And unfortunately, Arabs and the what so-called the international community, or the society in the United States and in the Arab world, all of them, they are looking at this catastrophe without paying any kind of feeling or having passion or compassion towards these people, these children, these women who are looking for food and looking for life and looking for a safe place, safe haven in order to live. Unfortunately, this international community has been seeing and looking and to this problem without raising finger, without raising voice, without even condemning such acts of the of these atrocities of the Zionists. And also they talk about more dangerous thing that Witkoff or others talk to Katz or some of the Israelis, especially the Mossad, talking about delivering the Palestinians as if they are commodities to Libya and Ethiopia and also to Indonesia. It's unfortunate to see this problem is taking these ramifications in all aspects, in terms of nationality, in terms of religion, in terms of homeland, in terms of culture, and all kinds of concepts and technical terms that we use in the media. I guess Gaza is fighting alone, well, with some help from Yemen, from taban the axis of resistance, which will come back soon, will come back, because this international community cannot stay like this. There are people who are fighting and who are collecting themselves and their efforts in order to defend Palestine and defend Gaza. And soon will the people in Palestine and the Arab world will have this revolt and rebellion against these plans and these conspiracies against the Palestinians, and Palestine will be the beginning. What's going on in Syria, what's going on in Lebanon, what's going on in Iraq and other places, I guess it's in the same track, in the same way of understanding. The United States and the Israelis, of course, the Zionists, are creating this chaos in order, what's so-called, to create a new Middle East, as Netanyahu expressed it, according to his greediness and according to his inhumane understanding of the relationship between the Arabs and the Israelis, and of course the international community. I would say I would blame, not only blame, condemn the Arab silence about what's happening in Gaza, especially those who are negotiating the truce and the ceasefire in Gaza. Aren't they saying seeing what's happening in Gaza every day? The Israelis, the Zionists, these criminals are killing more than 100 Palestinian. That's between children and women who are seeking food, seeking a piece of bread in order to eat and try to satiate, if they satiate, their stomach and their food and their hunger. I would say that these Arabs take the responsibility as the Americans, as the European Union, but the Arabs can be blamed more because they are on the borders. Yes. What are they doing except talking to the Israelis?
Yes.
You should cut. You should boycott all kinds of relations with this usurpation and with this occupation and with this killing. They are witnesses for these crimes.
Yes. Okay, stay with me. Let's cross over back to Ramallah. I guess Israel, in some aspect, can now claim that some of its war goals has been realized. Why? Because from the very beginning, Yon Golant said that when the genocide began, there will be no food, there will be no water, there will be no electricity. Everything will be cut off. And we saw the systematic attack on the UNRWA, on, you know, food aid companies and organizations that came to try to replace the UNRWA, and then the United States tried the pair where they claim it's going to be the pair they're going to be using to bring aid in. That failed, and now we have the, what is it called, the Gaza, so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that the UN has now called a debt trap. We spoke to our correspondent earlier today, and he said a bag of flour now costs $1,000. People are literally going 5 days without food. In your opinion, how can the international community, or whatever is left of it, deal with this kind of fundamental fracture in human existence? Because it's not going to go away, is it?
Yes, that's absolutely right. What they can do lots of things. They can do a lot, as a matter of fact, in ending this this situation. But the question is whether they can or whether they want to. do something about it. This is the problem. They have the ability to do it. They can boycott Israel. They can force Israel. They can go to the United Nations General Assembly. They can go to the Security Council. They can force Israel to do it. They can stop all kind of relationship with Israel if they continue with this. Arab countries, as your guest also mentioned, especially Egypt, who have all these food and aid on their borders, it's a matter of their own supremacy over Rafah crossing, and it's a matter of supremacy over their own land. And this crossing is between the Palestinians and Egypt, so they can open it, forced to open it, in spite of everything. They can do all these kind of things. There are a lot of things they can do. But the question is whether they are willing to do that or not. And this is the problem. That's why we are saying that all these countries, and especially Arab countries, are conspiring with the Israelis and the Americans against the Palestinian people. We hold them responsibility for this massacre is going on in a genocide war. They are responsible for what's going on. Because, and even the European countries and all other countries who did not do anything at all, once you know what's going on and you see what's going on and you do nothing at all, it means that you are participating in this crime. So that's exactly the situation. Now, for the UNRWA announced today that they have enough food and aid for Gaza, enough for 3 months for all the people in Gaza, the 2.3 million people in Gaza. They have enough food for them and water and supplies for 3 months at least. But all that aid is stuck at the borders, either in Rafah or in the other Israeli crossings. And Israel and the Americans are not allowing at all this kind of help and aid to get into Gaza. So this is a United Nations organization. So what the United Nations should do, and the United Nations now, they are sending all these reports. They are talking about everything, but at the same time, they are doing nothing, because they know that if there is a kind of a resolution coming from the Security Council, the American will stand to help Israel and to block and to veto any kind of resolution. And that's why we are saying that we should go to the General Assembly and try to force Security Council under the 7th article to do something about what's going on, and it is immediately. Otherwise, all these countries are participant in this massacre and in this genocidal war.
Okay, let's cross over back to Beirut. We had a speech from Abu Ubaidah a few days ago, I think it was yesterday, where many are saying that is one of his most direct speech yet, where he actually named some of the countries that refuse to participate to assist Gaza, and also talk about the fact that resistance operations continues across Gaza despite the inhumane condition that exists. And you also mentioned the fact that the resistance will not be able to sit out and continue to wait as this unimaginable catastrophe unfolds before the eyes of the world. In your opinion, what do you think may happen? Because many of I've already said that the resistance in Lebanon perhaps is weak, the resistance in Iraq is tied, the resistance in Gaza has been fighting on empty stomach for almost 2 years. Iran has gone to recently 12 days of altercation with the Israeli regime. What can the resistance do in this situation?
Well, as I always say and insist on, the access of resistance is strong and will come back stronger. And the operations in Gaza show that, and it's an evident for everybody that they continue to fight. And the Israelis, every day they say it's a dangerous day, it's a difficult day for them and for their soldiers and for their officers in Gaza, in Khan Yunis, in South Gaza, and in Nusayrat, and everywhere you will see operations. And they say that now, some of their analysts, political analysts, saying that we cannot uproot, or we cannot kill, or we cannot finish Hamas. That's why we should go to ceasefire in order to return their hostages. I would say that in spite of all this aggression from these Zionists, with the approval of the United States and the Western community, it's about time, as Abu Ubaidah said, for the Arabs, most of them, the elites in the political and for the cultural and for the social influences, I would say that they should all go to this battle in a one voice, in a unified voice, that saying, stop this massacre, stop this genocidal war against Gaza. And the resistance in Lebanon is not that weak. Yes. In Yemen, they are sending these missiles into the airport of Lad and also to all parts, to Eilat and other places. So we are talking about a battle, an open war with with this occupation, in spite of this. I would say the Arab humiliation and defeat in their psychological spirit and in their soul and in their mind, they cooperate with this enemy in order to stop this resistance and in order to besiege this resistance. But I would say there is no option between resistance and other choices.
Okay.
The resistance is our destiny.
Okay.
The resistance, in order to go for freedom, we have, and to liberate Gaza and other places, we have to fight till the end, because we need this kind of resistance. It's a historical resistance in Gaza for 21 months. They are continuing in spite of all these losses.
Yes,
but
okay.
I'm
so sorry to cut you short because we are out of time.
Freedom fighters, these stragglers who are fighting for these people who are strangled in Gaza.
Yes, okay, I'm sorry to cut you short. Finally, I just want to go to our guest in Ramallah in less than a minute, if you can, your final thought as a Palestinian academic, as someone who has witnessed more than half of this occupation and seen it with your own eyes. You grew up with it. Your final word, please, in less than a minute, if you can.
Well, I do agree with your guest from Beirut. We have to fight back. There is no other option in front of us. For the last 30 years, we tried the peace process and we tried negotiations, but this colonial aggression called Israel, this colonial state called Israel, definitely are not going to give the Palestinians anything, and there is no way to be together with the Israelis in any negotiations. The only way is to resist the occupation, to resist this country, and to end this country totally. This is the only option in front of the Palestinians, either to live as slaves under the Israelis or to fight back to end this entity totally and to end this colonial state.
Okay. End the colonial state. That is where we will end this night's spotlight as well. Thank you so much to our guests for joining us. Saad Nimeris, professor of political science, who joined us from Ramallah. We also have Mohsin Saleh, academic and political commentator, joining us from Beirut. Thank you so much for staying with us. From me, Zainab, and the rest of the team, goodbye.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Muslim lady. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be your host. And here with us, we have Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. Well, today again we have another chapter to turn over in the history of the role models, great women that are mentioned in the Islamic heritage that we have behind ourselves. So far, we have actually learned a lot of stuff from different women, like exemplary role models that have been common, ordinary women just like us. But then through the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, and through the learnings and teachings of the Holy Book of Quran, they have turned into this wise women that have been considered as role models in the Islamic heritage. So as for today, we also are going to get familiar with another woman, with another exemplary great woman that is going to teach us a lot of stuff to take into consideration in our everyday life.
Today, we're going to explore about Umm Ayman. She was the daughter of Salat ibn Amr, a wise, brave, and a very, very truthful woman who would actually come to Lady Zahra Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and, you know, learn from her. She would sought to learn her exemplary wisdom, her knowledge, her values, and she excelled in that knowledge. Actually, she did not just come and sit and gossip. She would learn from her, and then she really excelled in that knowledge to the extent that she attained a very high level of spiritual maturity and earned a very special title from Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who tells her mother, gives her the title of mother, and he also acknowledged her as a member of Ahlul Bayt, the household of Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah, that's too much, actually.
Yes. So now, who was this woman actually? Actually, she came. It's not just she was a student. She came to this household to learn things. And
then, what brought her into that title?
Yes. It was actually during the Battle of Uhud. Umm Ayman played a very, very dedicated role. She was treating the wounded in this war and distributing water. And when the rumor spread that Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam had been killed by the polytheists, Aws ibn Kati and some of the Bani Haritha abandoned their positions. You know, they just shaked and they abandoned their position and fled towards Shakra.
So these are the great, like the largest tribes of the time.
Yes. And Umm Ayman was deeply disturbed by seeing this, what is happening to our army. Then she was disturbed by this betrayal, actually, and in that distressed situation, she took some soil in her hand and scattered it over their faces. And she also got this spinning wheel and approached some of them and said, "Give me your swords and begin spinning."
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. We're still talking about Umm Ayman, and actually she serves as a role model to us as Muslim women. So we need to know more about her. So first thing I learned from her was her brevity, was actually her courageousness. Like being brave is one of her traits.
Yes. So I said she, again, was a very key part spent in the Battle of Khaybar. She was the only loyal servant to Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam from among the women of her tribe. She had two sons, Ayman and Usama. Who both, again, played very important roles in the Islamic history. Ayman fought very bravely in the Battle of Hunain, and then he got martyred in the noble cause. And Usama, again, he was appointed by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam as a commander of the Islamic army during the war against the Romans in the final days of his life. So first, she was herself a courageous woman, a brave woman. Now she's a brave mother.
Yeah, she has nurtured brave men, actually.
Yes, and she is selflessly ready to, you know, go, let them go join the Islamic army, let them get martyred in the noble cause.
Encourages her sons to go and be a part of the victory of Islam.
Yes. Now her unshakable faith is again demonstrated in another instant. After Lady Fatima Salam Laila passed away, Umme Ayman found it very unbearable to remain in Medina without her.
Mm-hmm.
She felt like Medina does not sound like Medina without Lady Fatima Salam Laila. So she left for Mecca, but on her way she reached the desert of Jaffa, where it was she felt very, very thirsty, and she had no water with her. She was thirsty to the extent that it felt like she is going to die.
Yeah.
But her eyes filled with tears and she prayed, "Oh Allah, would you make me die of thirst?" Despite being the slave of Lady Fatima, salam alayha.
Yeah.
And you know, after praying this, a bucket of heavenly water descended from the sky and Umme Ayman drank from it. And it's reported in the authentic supplementary books that this brave and martyr-loving lady is again going to come back along with 12 other women who will have the honor of appearing alongside Imam Zamana jalla ta'ala faraja during the reappearance of Imam, actually, where she will be tasked with again the task of nursing. She will be treating the wounded in the army of Imam.
Oh my God, that's too much.
Yes. Now, how she's example for today's
yeah.
women in a lot many ways, you know, her story shows us that women can play very, very important roles in supporting their communities and their leaders, supporting their leaders, even in the times of war or turmoil. I cannot say that it's a wartime that I have and I have no role because there's no jihad wajib on me, but I can be a nurse.
Exactly.
So because Lady Fatima Zahra Salamiyah has also played the role of being nurse
yeah.
in the Islamic wars, especially for her father and Imam Ali alayhi salam.
So in spite of being a woman, and she is not asked to go and attend a war, she did not just give up helping Islam. In another way, she came to lend her helping hand. How? In bringing up children who are faithful enough to be attending the victory of Islam. This is one way. Another way, for herself, to attend the army, not as a soldier, but as a nurse.
Yes.
As someone who's going to help the wounded people and
yes.
soldiers.
She showed us that it's not just education that you're gaining. It's not just education that you're taking in. It's also being a volunteer now. It's also the community service. It's not just I'm learning something and keeping it inside.
Mm-hmm.
She showed it practically. Now, come on, be a volunteer when volunteers are needed. Be a community service
yeah.
provider when your community needs that service. So also her upbringing of her sons, one of whom attained martyrdom, shows us the importance of nurturing, how you can nurture your children. It shows us how you can guide the next generation. So it's particularly relevant for the mothers today.
The importance actually of the teachings of the mother.
Yes, because mothers do play a very crucial role in shaping the lives of their children. And ultimately a nation, actually.
Exactly, because she is the one who's going to shape their identity.
Yes.
She's the one who's going to teach them how to be courageous, how to be brave, how to be steadfast, and how to be a real faithful obedient of Allah and to Islam, of course. Women have always been game changers in different pages of history in many ways, like these exemplary role models that you just brought up in Muslim Lady and you talked about them. We can see that these women have been effective and so important in their own time through different ways, like in the case of Umme Ayman. The way she was brave was so clear and obvious, and that was her trait and characteristic that actually made her such a bold figure in the history, in the Islamic history.
Yes, we said that these examples also show us how you can be great mothers or how you can be community changers.
Exactly.
Or even if you don't have children, still you can be community changers. You know, there's this another woman, her name is Maria, okay? Maria is the daughter of Saad and hails from Abdul Qiyas tribe. In Basra, Shiites would gather at her residence, learning about Islam and Shiism. So she actually dedicated her house, her residence, as a place of learning. So people would come and learn about Islam at her place. You know, sometimes you do have good people around you want to learn from, but you don't have a place.
Exactly.
You say, where should we meet? In the park, in the, I don't know, where we don't have any external distractions and disturbances. So she dedicates her house. Imam Baqir al-Islam says that Maria was a devoted Shia woman and her home served as a pivotal meeting point for Shia followers. The gatherings at Maria's abode led Yazid bin Nabith to align himself with Imam Hussein al-Islam and ultimately leading him the honor of being martyred in Karbala with his two sons. Also, other people like Amir, Saf bin Malik, Adham bin Umayyah, these were among those who were nurtured in her own household and they were ultimately set out for Karbala.
Yeah, so they are the graduates of that house.
Yes. So Maria's home actually became a focal point for gatherings that promoted unity, that promoted faith, that promoted the lessons of Imams, the Islamic teachings. So today the mothers and women can again emulate her by creating spaces for meaningful conversations and building strong community. Because, you know, there's so much required. We say, we wish we had this Quranic circle around and we would gather around and talk around. It's not necessary you go around with women and gather around a table and start talking. Maria teaches us this. Rather than these gossiping points, you can turn your places into...
Oh, it's not just about gossiping. I have to defend all the women out there. It's not just about gossiping, but you mean that purposeful sort of discussions.
Exactly.
Like we could have a gathering together with all our friends. Female gatherings that we have, but we can use this gathering in a purposeful way, in a way that is going to serve my world, my mundane worldly self, as well as my hereafter.
Exactly. Because we do allow our spaces to be a place of learning, especially in the Muharrams, but why confined to Muharrams?
Exactly.
Only? Why not beyond that? Yeah. Why not? Why we are not contemplating in Quran? Have you seen how less is that, unfortunately, in our society, is that we call each other and or we make a group and we say, come on, this Thursday night or this Friday, let's contemplate on Surah. You know,
exactly. We have it in our culture, like in Iran, the women. Actually, it's an old tradition. Maybe nowadays you can see less of it, but still, there exists some people that the neighbors gather in one house, and then in there they start reciting the Holy Book of Quran. And one of those women perhaps knows much more about the interpretation of each verse. Then she's going to share all her knowledge with the other neighbors. And that's a very fruitful and purposeful gathering, actually.
This, explaining Maria's example again, compels us to say that make this culture more and more prevalent.
Prevailing, yeah. That must be prevailing everywhere. And that must be so common among all the women out there. Because there are a lot of books to contemplate upon, to ponder upon, like Nahjul Balagha by Imam Ali alayhi salam, or... of course, the Holy Book of Quran. There are a lot of verses that we do not know the interpretations or different aspects of them. But if we know, that would be reflected in our lives, in our mentality, in the way we treat other people. So it's going to change a lot.
Exactly. So as women, embrace your roles as influential figures to change your community. Be community builders. Do the advocacy for justice by just providing the space.
So you do not need... an official platform to practice something that is going to help you flourish yourself more and more. No, just a simple room in your house that's going to do the trick. And you could have these fruitful gathering with other women. So this was all the time that we had for today. I hope you have just enjoyed it. Thank you for being with us. Until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials.
trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the vast sky of Iran's history, certain names shine like brilliant stars. Names that, through steadfastness and devotion, have earned not only victories on the battlefield, but a place in the hearts of every Iranian. The commanders of this land from ancient times to today have always stood as symbols of resistance, courage, and sacrifice. Relying on faith, knowledge, and a deep love for their homeland, they have confronted every threat and defended the honor and integrity of this nation. Commander Ghulam Ali Rashid is one of those immortal names, a man whose presence on the battlefield struck fear into the heart of the enemy and whose patriotic zeal served as an unbreakable shield for his country. A time life spent defending Iran and its ideals ultimately culminated in his martyrdom during the Zionist regime's aggression against Iran. His name is now recorded forever in the scroll of this land's glory. Born in 1953 in the city of Desfoul in the southern province of Khuzestan, Ghulam Ali Rashid stepped onto the path of jihad from an early age. His political activities against the Pahlavi regime reflected the determined will of this remarkable man. Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, due to his anti-regime actions, he was arrested and transferred to Ahvaz, where he served a 9-year prison sentence. That prison term became a turning point, bringing him into contact with prominent figures such as Mohsen Rezai and Ali Shamkhani, who would later become senior commanders in the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC. In 1976, he was arrested again in Isfahan and transferred to Tehran, spending yet another year in prison. But even prison walls could not contain his resolve. Upon release, he resumed his struggle with renewed strength on the front lines of truth against tyranny. Following the establishment of the IRGC, Ghulam Ali Rashid began his service as the Deputy for Intelligence and Operations in the Desfoul IRGC. during the Iraqi Ba'ath regime's imposed war against Iran, he rose to become one of the Iran's senior commanders, playing a pivotal role in many major operations. Beyond his military service, Commander Rashid was also a leader in the realm of knowledge and education. He held a master's degree in political geography from the University of Tehran and a PhD in the same field from Terbiyat Mudarris University. He also served as an associate professor and faculty member at both the Supreme National Defense University and Imam Hussein University, training generations of future defense scholars and officers. Elevated to the rank of Major General, he was appointed Deputy Chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, and he also served as Deputy for Defense Affairs at the Secretariat of the Supreme National Security Council. And finally, the proud culmination of this honorable path was the martyrdom that testifies to his ultimate level of loyalty and self-sacrifice. On the morning of Friday, June 13, 2025, Commander Rashid attained martyrdom in a cowardly Israeli missile strike on Tehran, sacrificing his life in defense of the homeland he had so long protected. Throughout decades of service, his record was one of wisdom, leadership, and unmatched bravery. As one of the chief commanders of the Sacred Defense era, he played a vital role in planning and executing major, decisive military operations. His active presence on the front lines and his sensitive roles, such as Deputy for Intelligence and Operations in Dizful, bear witness to his deep involvement and commitment to defending the country's borders. His ability to coordinate between the Army and IRGC at Khatam al-Anbiya headquarters, the highest operational command structure of Iran's armed forces, was a clear reflection of his exceptional strategic and managerial capabilities. This distinguished performance made him one of the chief architects of Iran's post-revolutionary defensive power. What doubled the strength of Commander Rashid was not only his military ability, but his insight and intellectual depth. His academic background in political geography and his scientific activities in prestigious institutions gave his military analysis profound richness. He was not merely a battlefield commander, he was a thoughtful strategist who fused theoretical knowledge with experience. This combination of scholarship, experience, and foresight made him a heavyweight figure not only in combat zones, but also in strategy rooms and high-level planning sessions. His presence lent great weight to decisions and operations, making him a model of both power and prudence. In the end, the martyrdom of Commander Rashid is a cowardly act of Israeli aggression, highlighted the peak of his strength and faithfulness to the nation and its ideals. To his final breath, he wore the uniform of service and defense. His life is textbook in resistance, sacrifice, and patriotism. His brilliance and unparalleled courage remain a lasting legacy, a legacy that secures his name an eternal place in the proud history of Iran.
Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán recitadas por el señor Vaghefi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر